Disc 4.
Chapter 3. The next day we made a pavilion in the valley between the town and the English encampment, stretching two ships' sails between timber poles, the whole thing supported by seal-hide ropes lashed to pegs. And there the English placed three high-backed chairs for King Burgred, King Ethelred and Prince Alfred, and draped the chairs with rich red cloths. Ivar and Ubba sat on milking stools. Both sides brought 30 or 40 men to witness the discussions, which began with an agreement that all weapons were to be piled 20 paces behind the two delegations. I helped carry swords, axes, shields and spears, then went back to listen. Beorka was there, and he spotted me. He smiled. I smiled back. He was standing just behind the young man I took to be Alfred, for though I had heard him in the night, I had not seen him clearly. He alone among the three English leaders was not crowned with a circlet of gold, though he did have a large jewelled cloak brooch that Ivar eyed rapaciously. I saw, as Alfred took his seat, that the prince was thin, long-legged, restless, pale and tall. His face was long, his nose long, his beard short, his cheeks hollow and his mouth pursed. His hair was a nondescript brown, his eyes worried, his brow creased, his hands fidgety and his face frowning. He was only 19, I later learned, but he looked 10 years older. His brother, King Ethelred, was much older, over 30, and he was also long-faced, but burlier, and even more anxious-looking, while Burgred, King of Mercia, was a stubby man, heavy-bearded with a bulging belly and a balding pate. Alfred said something to Beorka, who produced a sheet of parchment and a quill, which he gave to the prince. Beorka then held a small vial of ink so that Alfred could dip the quill and write.
"What is he doing?" Ivar asked.
"He is making notes of our talks," the English interpreter answered.
"Notes?"
"So there is a record, of course."
"He has lost his memory?"
Ivar asked, while Ubba produced a very small knife and began to clean his fingernails. Ragnar pretended to write on his hand, which amused the Danes.
"You are Ivar and Ubba?"
Alfred asked through his interpreter.
"They are," our translator answered.
Alfred's pen scratched, while his brother and brother-in-law, both kings, seemed content to allow the young prince to question the Danes.
"You are sons of Lothbrok?"
Alfred continued.
"Indeed," the interpreter answered.
"And you have a brother, Halfdan?"
"Tell the bastard to shove his writing up his arse,"
Ivar snarled,
"and to shove the quill up after it, and then the ink until he shits black feathers."
"My lord says we are not here to discuss family," the interpreter said suavely, "but to decide your fate."
"And to decide yours,"
Burgred spoke for the first time.
"Our fate?"
Ivar retorted, making the Mercian king quail from the force of his skull gaze.
"Our fate is to water the fields of Mercia with your blood, dung the soil with your flesh, pave it with your bones, and rid it of your filthy stink."
The discussion carried on like that for a long time, both sides threatening, neither yielding. But it had been the English who called for the meeting, and the English who wanted to make peace, and so the terms were slowly hammered out. It took 2 days, and most of us who were listening became bored and lay on the grass in the sunlight. Both sides ate in the field, and it was during one such meal that Beorka cautiously came across to the Danish side and greeted me warily.
"You're getting tall, Uhtred," he said.
"It is good to see you, father," I answered dutifully. Ragnar was watching, but without any sign of worry on his face.
"You're still a prisoner, then?"
Beorka asked.
"I am," I lied. He looked at my 2 silver arm rings, which, being too big for me, rattled at my wrist.
"A privileged prisoner," he said wryly.
"They know I am an elderman," I said.
"Which you are,"
God knows, though your uncle denies it. I've heard nothing of him, I said truthfully. Beorka shrugged. He holds Bebenberg. He married your father's wife, and now she is pregnant.
Guther? I was surprised. Pregnant?
They want a son, Beorka said, and if they have one...
He did not finish the thought, nor did he need to. I was the Elderman, and Aelfric had usurped my place, yet I was still his heir and would be until he had a son.
The child must be born any day now, Beorka said. But you need not worry. He smiled and leaned toward me so he could speak in a conspiratorial whisper. I brought the parchments.
I looked at him with utter incomprehension.
You brought the parchments?
Your father's will. The land charters. He was shocked that I did not immediately understand what he had done.
I have the proof that you are the Elderman.
I am the Elderman, I said, as if proof did not matter, and always will be.
Not if Aelfric has his way, Beorka said. And if he has a son, then he will want the boy to inherit.
Guther's children always die, I said.
You must pray that every child lives, Beorka said crossly. But you are still the Elderman. I owe that to your father, God rest his soul.
So, you abandoned my uncle? I asked.
Yes, I did, he said eagerly, plainly proud that he had fled Bebenberg. I am English, he went on, his crossed eyes blinking in the sun. So I came south, Uhtred, to find Englishmen willing to fight the pagans. Englishmen able to do God's will, and I found them in Wessex. They are good men, godly men, stalwart men.
Aelfric doesn't fight the Danes? I asked.
I knew he did not, but I wanted to hear it confirmed. Your uncle wants no trouble, Beorka said. And so the pagans thrive in Northumbria, and the light of our Lord Jesus Christ grows dimmer every day.
He put his hands together as if in prayer, his palsied left hand quivering against his ink-stained right.
And it is not just Aelfric who succumbs. Ricsig of Dunholm gives them feasts. Egbert sits on their throne, and for that betrayal there must be weeping in heaven. It must be stopped, Uhtred, and I went to Wessex because the king is a godly man and knows it is only with God's help that we can defeat the pagans. I shall see if Wessex is willing to ransom you.
That last sentence took me by surprise, so that instead of looking pleased, I looked puzzled, and Beorka frowned.
You didn't hear me? He asked. You want to ransom me? Of course. You are noble, Uhtred, and you must be rescued. Alfred can be generous about such things.
I would like that, I said, knowing it was what I was supposed to say.
You should meet Alfred, he said enthusiastically. You'll enjoy that.
I had no wish to meet Alfred, certainly not after listening to him whimper about a servant girl he had humped. But Beorka was insistent, and so I went to Ragnar and asked his permission. Ragnar was amused.
Why does the squinty bastard want you to meet Alfred? He asked, looking at Beorka.
He wants me to be ransomed. He thinks Alfred might pay.
Pay good money for you?
Ragnar laughed.
Go on, he said carelessly. It never hurts to see the enemy close up.
Alfred was with his brother, some distance away, and Beorka talked to me as he led me toward the royal group.
Alfred is his brother's chief helper, he explained. King Ethelred is a good man, but nervous. He has sons, of course, but both are very young.
His voice trailed away.
So if he dies, I said, the eldest son becomes king?
No, no, Beorka sounded shocked. Ethelwold's much too young. He's no older than you.
But he's the king's son, I insisted.
When Alfred was a small boy, Beorka leaned down and lowered his voice, though not its intensity. His father took him to Rome, to see the Pope, and the Pope, Uhtred, invested him as the future king. He stared at me as if he had proved his point. But he's not the heir, I said, puzzled.
The Pope made him heir,
Beoka hissed at me. Later, much later, I met a priest who'd been in the old king's entourage, and he said Alfred had never been invested as the future king, but instead had been given some meaningless Roman honour. But Alfred, to his dying day, insisted the Pope had conferred the succession on him, and so justified his usurpation of the throne that by rights should have gone to Ethelred's eldest son. But if Ethelwold grows up, I began, then of course he might become king, Beoka interrupted me impatiently. But if his father dies before Ethelwold grows up, then Alfred will be king.
Then Alfred will have to kill him, I said. Him and his brother.
Beoka gazed at me in shocked amazement. Why do you say that? He asked.
He has to kill them, I said, just like my uncle wanted to kill me.
He did want to kill you. He probably still does, Beoka made the sign of the cross. But Alfred is not Aelfric.
No, no, Alfred will treat his nephews with Christian mercy.
Of course he will, which is another reason he should become king. He is a good Christian, Uhtred, as I pray you are, and it is God's will that Alfred should become king.
The Pope proved that, and we have to obey God's will. It is only by obedience to God that we can hope to defeat the Danes.
Only by obedience? I asked. I thought swords might help.
Only by obedience, Beoka said firmly, and by faith. God will give us victory if we worship him with all our hearts, and if we mend our ways and give him the glory, and Alfred will do that.
With him at our head, the very hosts of heaven will come to our aid.
Ethelwold can't do that.
He's a lazy, arrogant, tiresome child. Beoka seized my hand and pulled me through the entourage of West Saxon and Mercian lords.
Now remember to kneel to him, boy. He is a prince.
He led me to where Alfred was sitting, and I duly knelt as Beoka introduced me.
This is the boy I spoke of, Lord, he said. He is the Ealdorman Uhtred of Northumbria, a prisoner of the Danes since Eofric fell, but a good boy.
Alfred gave me an intense look that, to be honest, made me uncomfortable. I was to discover in time that he was a clever man, very clever, and thought twice as fast as most others. And he was also a serious man, so serious that he understood everything, except jokes. Alfred took everything heavily, even a small boy, and his inspection of me was long and searching, as if he tried to plumb the depths of my unfledged soul.
Are you a good boy? He finally asked me.
I try to be, Lord, I said.
Look at me,
he ordered, for I had lowered my eyes. He smiled when I met his gaze. There was no sign of the sickness he had complained of when I eavesdropped on him, and I wondered if, after all, he had been drunk that night. It would have explained his pathetic words, but now he was all earnestness.
How do you try to be good? He asked.
I try to resist temptation, Lord, I said, remembering Beoka's words to him behind the tent.
That's good, he said. Very good. And do you resist it?
Not always, I said.
Then hesitated, tempted to mischief, and then, as ever, yielded to temptation.
But I try, Lord, I said earnestly, and I tell myself I should thank God for tempting me, and I praise him when he gives me the strength to resist the temptation.
Both Beoka and Alfred stared at me, as if I had sprouted angel's wings. I was only repeating the nonsense I had heard Beoka advise Alfred in the dark, but they thought it revealed my great holiness, and I encouraged them by trying to look meek, innocent, and pious.
You are a sign from God, Uhtred, Alfred said fervently.
Do you say your prayers?
Every day, Lord, I said, and did not add that those prayers were addressed to Odin.
And what is that about your neck? A crucifix?
He had seen the leather thong, and when I did not answer, he leaned forward and plucked out Thor's hammer that had been hidden behind my shirt.
Dear God,
he said, and made the sign of the cross.
And you wear those too?
He added, grimacing at my two arm rings that were cut with Danish rune letters. I must have looked a proper little heathen.
They make me wear them, Lord,
I said, and felt his impulse to tear the pagan symbol off the thong.
And beat me if I don't, I added hastily. Do they beat you often?
He asked.
All the time, Lord, I lied.
He shook his head sadly, then let the hammer fall.
A graven image, he said, must be a heavy burden for a small boy. I was hoping, Lord, Beorka intervened, that we could ransom him.
Us? Alfred asked.
Ransom him?
He is the true Elderman of Bebbanburg, Beorka explained, though his uncle has taken the title, but the uncle will not fight the Danes.
Alfred gazed at me, thinking, then frowned.
Can you read, Uhtred? He asked.
He has begun his lessons, Beorka answered for me. I taught him, Lord, though in all honesty he was ever a reluctant pupil. Not good with his letters, I fear. His thorns were prickly and his ashes spindly.
I said that Alfred did not understand jokes, but he loved that one, even though it was feeble as watered milk and stale as old cheese. But it was beloved of all who taught reading, and both Beorka and Alfred laughed as though the jest were fresh as dew at sunrise. The thorn, th, and the ash, sh, were two letters of our alphabet.
His thorns are prickly,
Alfred echoed, almost incoherent with laughter.
And his ashes spindly.
His bees don't buzz and his eyes...
He stopped, suddenly embarrassed. He had been about to say my eyes were crossed. Then he remembered Beorka, and he looked contrite.
My dear Beorka...
No offence, my lord, no offence. Beorka was still happy, as happy as when he was immersed in some tedious text about how St. Cuthbert baptised puffins or preached the gospel to the seals. He had tried to make me read that stuff, but I'd never got beyond the shortest words.
You are fortunate to have started your studies early, Alfred said to me, recovering his seriousness. I was not given a chance to read until I was 12 years old.
His tone suggested I should be shocked and surprised by this news, so I dutifully looked appalled.
That was grievously wrong of my father and stepmother, Alfred went on sternly. They should have started me much earlier.
Yet now you read as well as any scholar, my lord, Beorka said.
I do try,
Alfred said modestly, but he was plainly delighted with the compliment.
And in Latin too, Beorka said. And his Latin is much better than mine.
I think that's true, Alfred said, giving the priest a smile.
And he writes a clear hand, Beorka told me. Such a clear, fine hand.
As must you, Alfred told me firmly. To which end, young Uhtred, we shall indeed offer to ransom you. And if God helps us in that endeavour, then you shall serve my household. And the first thing you will do is become a master of reading and writing. You'll like that.
I will, Lord, I said, meaning it to sound as a question, though it came out as dull agreement.
You will learn to read well, Alfred promised me, and learn to pray well, and learn to be a good, honest Christian, and when you are of age you can decide what to be.
I will want to serve you, Lord, I lied, thinking that he was a pale, boring, priest-ridden weakling.
That is commendable, he said. And how will you serve me, do you think?
As a soldier, Lord, to fight the Danes.
If God wishes it,
he said, evidently disappointed in my answer.
And God knows we shall need soldiers, though I pray daily that the Danes will come to a knowledge of Christ, and so discover their sins, and be led to end their wicked ways. Prayer is the answer, he said vehemently. Prayer and fasting and obedience. And if God answers our prayers, Uhtred, then we shall need no soldiers. But a kingdom always has need of good priests. I wanted that office for myself, but God disposed otherwise. There is no higher calling than the priestly service. I might be a prince, but in God's eyes I am a worm, while Beoka is a jewel beyond price.
Yes, Lord, I said, for want of anything else to say.
Beoka tried to look modest.
Alfred leaned forward, hid Thor's hammer behind my shirt, then laid a hand on my head.
God's blessing on you, child, he said, and may his face shine upon you, and release you from your thraldom, and bring you into the blessed light of freedom.
Amen, I said. They let me go then, and I went back to Ragnar. Hit me, I said.
What?
Thump me round the head. He glanced up and saw that Alfred was still watching me, so he cuffed me harder than I expected. I fell down, grinning.
So, why did I just do that? Ragnar asked.
Because I said you were cruel to me, I said, and beat me constantly. I knew that would amuse Ragnar, and it did. He hit me again just for luck.
So, what did the bastards want? He asked.
They want to ransom me, I said, so they can teach me to read and write and then make me into a priest.
A priest? Like the squinty little bastard with the red hair?
Just like him. Ragnar laughed.
Maybe I should ransom you. It would be a punishment for telling lies about me.
Please don't, I said fervently. And at that moment I wondered why I had ever wanted to go back to the English side. To exchange Ragnar's freedom for Alfred's earnest piety seemed a miserable fate to me. Besides, I was learning to despise the English. They would not fight. They prayed instead of sharpening their swords. And it was no wonder the Danes were taking their land. Alfred did offer to ransom me, but balked at Ragnar's price that was ludicrously high, though not nearly so steep as the price Ivar and Ubba extracted from Burgred. Mercia was to be swallowed. Burgred had no fire in his big belly, no desire to go on fighting the Danes, who got stronger as he grew weaker. Perhaps he was fooled by all those shields on Snottingham's walls. But he must have decided he could not beat the Danes, and instead he surrendered. It was not just our forces in Snottingham that persuaded him to do this. Other Danes were raiding across the Northumbrian border, ravaging Mercian lands, burning churches, slaughtering monks and nuns. And those horsemen were now close to Burgred's army and were forever harassing his forage parties. And so Burgred, weary of unending defeat, weakly agreed to every outrageous demand. And in return, he was allowed to stay as King of Mercia. But that was all. The Danes were to take his fortresses and garrison them, and they were free to take Mercian estates as they wished. And Burgred's third was to fight for the Danes if they demanded it. And Burgred, moreover, was to pay a vast price in silver for this privilege of losing his kingdom while keeping his throne. Ethelred and Alfred, having no part to play in the discussions, and seeing that their ally had collapsed like a pricked bladder, left on the second day, riding south with what remained of their army, and thus Mercia fell. First Northumbria, then Mercia. In just 2 years, half of England was gone, and the Danes were only just beginning. We ravaged the land again. Bands of Danes rode into every part of Mercia and slaughtered whoever resisted, took whatever they wished, then garrisoned the principal fortresses before sending messages to Denmark for more ships to come. More ships, more men, more families, and more Danes to fill the great land that had fallen into their laps. I had begun to think I would never fight for England, because by the time I was old enough to fight, there would be no England. So I decided I would be a Dane. Of course, I was confused, but I did not spend much time worrying about my confusion. Instead, as I approached 12 years old, I began my proper education. I was made to stand for hours, holding a sword and shield stretched out in front of me until my arms ached. I was taught the strokes of the blade, made to practice with throwing spears, and given a pig to slaughter with a war spear. I learned to fend with a shield, how to drop it to stop the lunge beneath the rim, and how to shove the heavy shield boss into an enemy's face to smash his nose and blind him with tears. I learned to pull an oar. I grew, put on muscle, began to speak in a man's voice, and was slapped by my first girl. I looked like a Dane. Strangers still mistook me for Ragnar's son, for I had the same fair hair that I wore long and tied with a strip of leather at the nape of my neck. And Ragnar was pleased when that happened. Though he made it plain that I would not replace Ragnar the Younger or Rorik. "If Rorik lives," he said sadly, for Rorik was still sickly. "You will have to fight for your inheritance," Ragnar told me. And so I learned to fight, and that winter, to kill. We returned to Northumbria. Ragnar liked it there, and though he could have taken better land in Mercia, he liked the northern hills and the deep vales, and the dark hanging woods, where, as the first frosts crisped the morning, he took me hunting. A score of men and twice as many dogs beat through the woods, trying to trap boar. I stayed with Ragnar, both of us armed with heavy boar spears. "A boar can kill you, Ortred," he warned me.
"He can rip you from the crotch to the neck, unless you place the spear just right."
The spear, I knew, must be placed in the beast's chest, or, if you were lucky, down its throat. I knew I could not kill a boar, but if one came, I would have to try. A full-grown boar can be twice the weight of a man, and I did not have the strength to drive one back. But Ragnar was determined to give me first strike, and he would be close behind to help. And so it happened. I have killed hundreds of boars since, but I will always remember that first beast, the small eyes, the sheer anger, the determination, the stench, the bristling hairs flecked with mud, and the sweet thud of the spear going deep into the chest. And I was hurled back as if I had been kicked by Odin's eight-legged horse. And Ragnar drove his own spear through the thick hide, and the beast squealed and roared, legs a-scrabbling, and the pursuing dogs howled. And I found my feet, gritted my teeth, and put my weight on the spear and felt the boar's life pulsing up through the ash shaft. Ragnar gave me a tusk from that carcass, and I hung it next to Thor's hammer. And in the days that followed, I wanted to do nothing except hunt, though I was not allowed to pursue boar unless Ragnar was with me. But when Rorik was well enough, he and I would take our bows into the woods to look for deer. It was on one of those expeditions, high up at the edge of the woods, just beneath the moors that were dappled by melting snow, that the arrow almost took my life. Rorik and I were creeping through undergrowth, and the arrow missed me by inches, sizzling past my head to thump into an ash tree. I turned, putting an arrow on my own string, but saw no one. Then we heard feet racing away, downhill through the trees, and we followed. But whoever had shot the arrow ran too fast for us.
"An accident," Ragnar said. "He saw movement, thought you were a deer, and loosed. It happens."
He looked at the arrow we had retrieved, but it had no marks of ownership. It was just a goose-fledged shaft of hornbeam, tipped with an iron head.
"An accident," he decreed.
Later that winter, we moved back to Jofurik and spent days repairing the boats. I learned to split oak trunks with wedge and mallet, cleaving out the long pale planks that patched the rotted hulls.
Spring brought more ships,
more men, and with them was Halfdan, youngest brother of Ivar and Ubba. He came ashore roaring with energy, a tall man with a big beard and scowling eyes. He embraced Ragnar,
thumped me on the shoulder, punched Rorick in the head, swore he would kill every Christian in England, then went to see his brothers. The three of them planned the new war, which they promised would strip East Anglia of its treasures, and as the days warmed, we readied for it. Half the army would march by land, while the other half, which included Ragnar's men, would go by sea, and so I anticipated my first proper voyage. But before we left, Kjartan came to see Ragnar, and trailing him was his son Sven, his missing eye a red hole in his angry face. Kjartan knelt to Ragnar and bowed his head.
"I would come with you, Lord," he said.
Kjartan had made a mistake by letting Sven follow him, for Ragnar, usually so generous, gave the boy a sour look. I call him a boy, but in truth Sven was almost a man now, and promised to be a big one, broad in the chest, tall and strong.
"You would come with me?" Ragnar echoed flatly.
"I beg you, Lord," Kjartan said, and it must have taken a great effort to say those words, for Kjartan was a proud man. But in Jofurik he had found no plunder, earned no arm rings, and made no reputation for himself.
"My ships are full," Ragnar said coldly and turned away.
I saw the look of hatred on Kjartan's face.
"Why doesn't he sail with someone else?" I asked Raven.
"Because everyone knows he offended Ragnar. So to give him a place at the oars is to risk my son's dislike."
Raven shrugged.
"Kjartan should go back to Denmark. If a man loses his lord's trust, then he has lost everything."
But Kjartan and his one-eyed son stayed in Jofurik instead of going back to Denmark, and we sailed, first flowing with the current back down the Ouse and so into the Humber, where we spent the night. Next morning, we took the shields off the ship's sides, then waited till the tide lifted their hulls and we could row eastward into the first great seas. I had been offshore at Bebbanburg, going with fishermen to cast nets about the Farne Islands, but this was a different sensation. The wind viper rode those waves like a bird, instead of thrashing through like a swimmer. We rowed out of the river, then took advantage of a northwest wind to hoist the great sail, and the oars were fiddled out of their holes. The hulls were covered with wooden plugs, and the great sweep stored inboard as the sail cracked, bellied, trapped the wind and drove us southward. There were 89 ships altogether, a fleet of dragon-headed killers, and they raced one another, calling insults whenever they travelled faster than some other boat. Ragnar leaned on the steering oar, his hair flying in the wind and a smile as broad as the ocean on his face. Seal-hide ropes creaked. The boat seemed to leap up the seas, seethe through their tops, and slide in flying spray down their faces. I was frightened at first, for the wind viper bent to that wind, almost dropping her leeward side beneath the great green sea. But then I saw no fear on the other men's faces, and I learned to enjoy the wild ride, whooping with delight when the bow smashed into a heavy sea, and the green water flew like an arrow shower down the deck.
"I love this," Ragnar called to me. "In Valhalla I hope to find a ship, a sea and a wind."
The shore was ever in sight. A low green line to our right, sometimes broken by dunes, but never by trees or hills. And as the sun sank, we turned toward that land, and Ragnar ordered the sail furled and the oars out. We rowed into a water land, a place of marsh and reed, of bird cries and long-legged herons,
of eel traps and ditches, of shallow channels and long meres,
and I remembered my father saying the East Anglians were frogs. We were on the edge of their country now, at the place where Mercia ended and East Anglia began, in a tangle of water, mud and salt flats.
"They call it the Yawash," Ragnar said.
"You've been here?"
3 years ago," he said. "Good country to raid, Uhtred, but treacherous water, too shallow."
The Yawash was very shallow, and Wayland was in the Wind Viper's bow,
weighing the depth with a lump of iron tied to a rope. The oars only dipped if Wayland said there was sufficient water, and so we crept westward into the dying light, followed by the rest of the fleet. The shadows were long now, the red sun slicing into the open jaws of the dragon, serpent, and eagle heads on the ship's prows. The oars worked slowly, their blades dripping water as they swept forward for the next stroke, and our wake spread in long, slow ripples, touched red by dying sun fire. We anchored that night and slept aboard the ships, and in the dawn Ragnar made Rorik and me climb his mast. Ubba's ship was nearby, and he too had men clambering up toward the painted wind vane at the masthead. "What can you see?" Ragnar called up to us. "Three men on horseback," Rorik answered, pointing south. "Watching us." "And a village," I added, also pointing south. To the men on shore, we were something from their darkest fears. All they could see was a thicket of masts, and the savage carved beasts at the high prows and sterns of our ships. We were an army, brought here by our dragon boats, and they knew what would follow, and, as I watched, the three horsemen turned and galloped south. We went on. Ubba's ship led the way now, following a twisting shallow channel, and I could see Ubba's sorcerer, Storri, standing in the bows, and I guessed he had cast the runes and predicted success. "Today," Ragnar told me wolfishly, "you will learn the Viking way." To be a Viking was to be a raider, and Ragnar had not conducted a shipborne raid in many years. He had become an invader instead, a settler. But Ubba's fleet had come to ravage the coastline and draw the East Anglian army toward the sea, while his brother Ivar led the land army south from Mercia. And so that early summer, I learned the Viking ways. We took the ships to the mainland, where Ubba found a stretch of land with a thin neck that could easily be defended. And once our ships were safely drawn onto the beach, we dug an earthwork across the neck as a rampart. Then large parties of men disappeared into the countryside, returning next morning with captured horses, and the horses were used to mount another warband that rode inland as Ragnar led his men on foot along the tangled shoreline. We came to a village. I never did learn its name, and we burned it to the ground. There was no one there. We burned farmsteads and a church and marched on, following a road that angled away from the shore. And at dusk, we saw a larger village, and we hid in a wood, lit no fires, and attacked at dawn. We came shrieking from the half-light. We were a nightmare in the dawn. Men in leather with iron helmets. Men with round painted shields. Men with axes, swords, and spears. The folk in that place had no weapons and no armour, and perhaps they'd not even known there were Danes in their countryside, for they were not ready for us. They died. A few brave men tried to make a stand by their church, but Ragnar led a charge against them, and they were slaughtered where they stood. And Ragnar pushed open the church door to find the small building filled with women and children. The priest was in front of the altar, and he cursed Ragnar in Latin as the Dane stalked up the small nave, and the priest was still cursing when Ragnar disemboweled him. We took a bronze crucifix, a dented silver plate, and some coins from the church. We found a dozen good cooking pots in the houses, and some shears, sickles, and iron spits. We captured cattle, goats, sheep, oxen, 8 horses, and 16 young women. One woman screamed that she could not leave her child, and I watched Wayland spit the small boy on a spear, then thrust the bloodied corpse into the woman's arms. Ragnar sent her away, not because he pitied her, but because one person was always spared to carry news of the horror to other places. Folk must fear the Danes, Ragnar said, and then they would be ready to surrender. He gave me a piece of burning wood he had taken from a fire. "Burn the thatch, Uhtred," he ordered. So I went from house to house, putting fire to the reed thatch. I burned the church, and then, just as I approached the last house, a man burst from the door with a 3-pronged eel spear that he lunged at me. I twisted aside,
avoiding his thrust by look rather than judgment, and I hurled the burning wood at the man's face, and the flames made him duck as I backed away. And Ragnar threw me a spear, a heavy war spear made for thrusting rather than throwing, and it skidded in the dust in front of me, and I understood he was letting me fight as I plucked it up. He would not have let me die, for he had two of his bowmen standing ready with arrows on their strings. But he did not interfere as the man ran at me and lunged again. I parried, knocking the rusted eel spear aside and stepping back again to give myself room. The man was twice my size and more than twice my weight. He was cursing me, calling me a devil's bastard, a worm of hell, and he rushed me again. And I did what I had learned hunting the boar. I stepped to my left, waited till he levelled the spear, stepped back to the right and thrust. It was not a clean thrust, nor did I have the weight to hurl him back, but the spear point punctured his belly, and then his weight pushed me back as he half snarled and half gasped, and I fell, and he fell on top of me, forced sideways because the spear was in his guts. And he tried to take a grip of my throat, but I wriggled out from beneath him, picked up his own eel spear, and rammed it at his throat. There were rivulets of blood on the earth, droplets spraying in the air, and he was jerking and choking, blood bubbling at his ripped throat. And I tried to pull the eel spear back, but the barbs on the points were caught in his gullet. So I ripped the war spear from his belly and tried to stop him jerking by thrusting it down hard onto his chest, but it only glanced off his ribs. He was making a terrible noise, and I suppose I was in a panic, and I was unaware that Ragnar and his men were almost helpless with laughter as they watched me try to kill the East Anglian. I did in the end, or else he just bled to death. But by then I had poked and stabbed and torn him until he looked as though a pack of wolves had set on him. But I got a third arm ring, and there were grown warriors in Ragnar's band who only wore three. Rorik was jealous, but he was younger, and his father consoled him that his time would come. "How does it feel?" Ragnar asked me. "Good," I said, and God help me, it did. It was then that I first saw Breda. She was my age, black-haired, thin as a twig, with big dark eyes and a spirit as wild as a hawk in spring. And she was among the captured women, and as the Danes began dividing those captives among themselves, an older woman pushed the child forward, as if giving her to the Vikings. Breda snatched up a piece of wood and turned on the woman and beat at her, driving her back, screaming that she was a sour-faced bitch, a dried-up hank of gristle. And the older woman tripped and fell into a patch of nettles where Breda went on thrashing her. Ragnar was laughing, but eventually pulled the child away, and because he loved anyone with spirit, gave her to me. "Keep her safe," he said, "and burn that last house." So I did, and I learned another thing. Start your killers young, before their consciences are grown. Start them young and they will be lethal. We took our plunder back to the ships, and that night as I drank my ale, I thought of myself as a Dane. Not English, not anymore. I was a Dane, and I'd been given a perfect childhood, perfect at least to the ideas of a boy. I was raised among men. I was free. I ran wild. I was encumbered by no laws, I was troubled by no priests, I was encouraged to violence, and I was rarely alone. And it was that I was rarely alone, which kept me alive. Every raid brought more horses, and more horses meant more men could go farther afield and waste more places, steal more silver and take more captives. We had scouts out now, watching for the approach of King Edmund's army. Edmund ruled East Anglia, and unless he wished to collapse as feebly as Burghred of Mercia, he had to send men against us to preserve his kingdom, and so we watched the roads and waited. Breda stayed close to me. Ragnar had taken a strong liking to her, probably because she treated him defiantly and because she alone did not weep when she was captured. She was an orphan and had been living in the house of her aunt, the woman whom she had beaten and whom she hated.
and within days Breda was happier among the Danes than she'd ever been among her own people. She was a slave now, a slave who was supposed to stay in the camp and cook. But one dawn as we went raiding, she ran after us and hauled herself up behind my saddle, and Ragnar was amused by that and let her come along. We went far south that day, out of the flatlands where the marshes stretched and into low wooded hills among which were fat farms and a fatter monastery. Breda laughed when Ragnar killed the abbot, and afterward, as the Danes collected their plunder, she took my hand and led me over a low rise to a farm that had already been plundered by Ragnar's men. The farm belonged to the monastery, and Breda knew the place because her aunt had frequently gone to the monastery to pray. She wanted children, Breda said, and only had me. Then she pointed at the farm and watched for my reaction. It was a Roman farm, she told me, though like me she had little idea who the Romans really were, only that they had once lived in England and then had gone. I had seen plenty of their buildings before. There were some in Jofaric, but those other buildings had crumbled, then had been patched with mud and re-roofed with thatch, while this farm looked as though the Romans had only just left. It was astonishing. The walls were of stone, perfectly cut, square and close-mortared, and the roof was of tile, patterned and tight-fitting, and inside the gate was a courtyard surrounded with a pillared walkway, and in the largest room was an amazing picture on the floor, made up of thousands of small coloured stones, and I gaped at the leaping fish that were pulling a chariot in which a bearded man stood holding an eel spear like the one I had faced in Breeder's village. Hares surrounded the picture, chasing one another through looping strands of leaves. There had been other pictures painted on the walls, but they had faded, or else been discoloured by water that had leaked through the old roof. It was the abbot's house, Breda told me, and she took me into a small room where there was a cot beside which one of the abbot's servants lay dead in his own blood. He brought me in here, she said. The abbot did? And told me to take my clothes off. The abbot did? I asked again. I ran away, she said in a very matter-of-fact tone, and my aunt beat me. She said I should have pleased him and he'd have rewarded us.
We wandered through the house, and I felt a wonder that we could no longer build like this. We knew how to sink posts in the ground and make beams and rafters and roof them with thatch from rye or reed, but the posts rotted, the thatch moulded and the houses sagged. In summer, our houses were winter dark, and all year they were choked with smoke, and in winter they stank of cattle. Yet this house was light and clean, and I doubted any cow had ever dunged on the man in his fish-drawn chariot. It was an unsettling thought that somehow we were sliding back into the smoky dark, and that never again would man make something so perfect as this small building. Were the Romans Christians? I asked Breda.
Don't know, she said. Why?
Nothing, I said. But I had been thinking that the gods reward those they love, and it would have been nice to know which gods had looked after the Romans. I hoped they had worshipped Odin, though these days I knew they were Christians because the Pope lived in Rome. And Beorca had taught me that the Pope was the chief of all the Christians, and was a very holy man. His name, I remembered, was Nicholas. Breda could not have cared less about the gods of the Romans. Instead, she knelt to explore a hole in the floor that seemed to lead only to a cellar so shallow that no person could ever get inside. Maybe elves lived there, I suggested.
Elves live in the woods, she insisted.
She decided the abbot might have hidden treasures in the space and borrowed my sword so she could widen the hole. It was not a real sword, merely a sax, a very long knife, but Ragnar had given it to me and I wore it proudly. Don't break the blade, I told her, and she stuck her tongue out at me, then began prizing the mortar at the hole's edge, while I went back to the courtyard to look at the raised pond that was green and scummy now, but somehow I knew it had once been filled with clear water. A frog crawled onto the small stone island in the centre, and I again remembered my father's verdict on the East Anglians, mere frogs. Wayland came through the gate. He stopped just inside and licked his lips, tongue flickering, then half-smiled.
Lost your sack, Sotred?
No, I said. Ragnar sent me, he said. We are leaving. I nodded, said nothing, but knew that Ragnar would have sounded a horn if we were truly ready to leave. So, come on, boy, he said. I nodded again, still said nothing. His dark eyes glanced at the building's empty windows, then at the pool. Is that a frog? He asked. Or a toad? A frog. In Francia, he said, men say you can eat frogs. He walked towards the pool, and I moved to stay on the far side from him, keeping the raised stone structure between us. Have you eaten a frog, Uhtred? No. Would you like to? No. He put a hand into a leather bag that hung from his sword belt, which was strapped over a torn mail coat. He had money now, 2 arm rings, proper boots, an iron helmet, a long sword, and the mail coat that needed mending, but was far better protection than the rags he had worn when he first came to Ragnar's house. This coin, if you catch a frog, he said, spinning a silver penny in the air. I don't want to catch a frog, I said sullenly. I do, he said, grinning, and he drew the sword, its blade hissing on the scabbard's wooden throat, and he stepped into the pool, the water not reaching the tops of his boots, and the frog leaped away, plopping into the green scum, and Wayland was not looking at the frog, but at me, and I knew he was going to kill me, but for some reason I could not move. I was astonished, and yet I was not astonished. I had never liked him, never trusted him, and I understood that he had been sent to kill me and had only failed because I had always been in company until this moment when I had let Breeda lead me away from Ragnar's band. So Wayland had his chance now. He smiled at me, reached the center of the pool, came closer, raised the sword, and I found my feet at last and raced back into the pillared walkway. I did not want to go into the house, for Breeda was there, and I knew he would kill her if he found her. He jumped out of the pond and chased me, and I raced down the walkway, around the corner, and he cut me off, and I dodged back, wanting to reach the gateway. But he knew that was what I wanted, and he took care to keep between me and my escape. His boots left wet footprints on the Roman flagstones. What's the matter, Uhtred? He asked. Frightened of frogs? What do you want? I asked. Not so cocky now, eh, Elderman? He stalked toward me, sword flashing from side to side. Your uncle sends his regards and trusts you will burn in hell while he lives in Bebbanburg. You come from... I began. But it was obvious Wayland was serving Aelfric, so I did not bother to finish the question, but instead edged backward. The reward for your death will be the weight of his newborn child in silver, Wayland said, and the child should be born by now. And he's impatient for your death, your uncle is. I almost managed to track you down that night outside Snottingham, and almost hit you with an arrow last winter, but you ducked. Not this time. But it will be quick, boy. Your uncle said to make it quick. So kneel down, boy. Just kneel. He swept the blade left and right, his wrist whippy so the sword hissed. I haven't given her a name yet, he said. Perhaps after this, she'll be known as Orphan Killer. I fainted right, went left, but he was quick as a stoat, and he blocked me, and I knew I was cornered, and he knew it too, and smiled. I'll make it quick, he said. I promise. Then the first roof tile hit his helmet. It could not have hurt much, but the unexpected blow jarred him backward and confused him, and the second tile hit his waist, and the third smacked him on the shoulder, and Breeda shouted from the roof, "Back through the house!" I ran, the lunging sword missing me by inches, and I twisted through the door, ran over the fish-drawn chariot, through a second door, another door, saw an open window and dove through, and Breeda jumped down from the roof and together we ran for the nearby woods. Wayland followed me, but he abandoned the pursuit when we vanished in the trees. Instead, he went south, on his own, fleeing what he knew Ragnar would do to him. And for some reason, I was in tears by the time I found Ragnar again. Why did I cry? I do not know. unless it was the confirmation that Bebbanburg was gone, that my beloved refuge was occupied by an enemy, and an enemy who, by now, might have a son. Breda received an arm ring, and Ragnar let it be known that if any man touched her, he, Ragnar, would personally geld that man with a mallet and a plank splitter. She rode home on Wayland's horse. And the next day, the enemy came. Raven had sailed with us, blind though he was, and I was required to be his eyes. So I described how the East Anglian army was forming on a low ridge of dry land to the south of our camp. "How many banners?" he asked me. 23, I said, after a pause to count them. "Showing?" "Mostly crosses," I said, "and some saints."
"He's a very pious man, King Edmund," Raven said. "He even tried to persuade me to become a Christian."
He chuckled at the memory. We were sitting on the prow of one of the beached ships, Raven in a chair, Breda and I at his feet, and the Mercian twins Chulnoth and Chulbert on his far side. They were the sons of Bishop Ethelbrid of Snottingham, and they were hostages even though their father had welcomed the Danish army. But as Raven said, taking the bishop's sons hostage would keep the man honest. There were dozens of other such hostages from Mercia and Northumbria, all sons of prominent men, and all under sentence of death if their fathers caused trouble. There were other Englishmen in the army, serving as soldiers, and if it were not for the language they spoke, they would have been indistinguishable from the Danes. Most of them were either outlaws or masterless men, but all were savage fighters, exactly the kind of men the English needed to face their enemy. But now those men were fighting for the Danes against King Edmund.
"And he's a fool," Raven said scornfully.
"A fool?" I asked.
"He gave us shelter during the winter, before we attacked your Ferric," Raven explained. "And we had to promise not to kill any of his churchmen," he laughed softly. "What a very silly condition. If their god was any use, then we couldn't have killed them anyway."
"Why did he give you shelter?"
"Because it was easier than fighting us," Raven said.
He was using English because the other three children did not understand Danish, though Breda was learning quickly. She had a mind like a fox, quick and sly. Raven smiled.
"The silly King Edmund believed we would go away in the springtime and not come back, yet here we are."
"He shouldn't have done it," one of the twins put in. I could not tell them apart, but was annoyed by them, for they were fierce Mercian patriots, despite the father's change of allegiance. They were 10 years old and forever upbraiding me for loving the Danes.
"Of course he shouldn't have done it," Raven agreed mildly.
"He should have attacked you,"
Chulnoth, or Chulbert, said.
"He would have lost if he had," Raven said. "We made a camp, protected it with walls, and stayed there. And he paid us money to make no trouble."
"I saw King Edmund once," Breda put in.
"Where was that, child?" Raven asked.
"He came to the monastery to pray," she said. "And he farted when he knelt down."
"No doubt their god appreciated the tribute," Raven said loftily, frowning because the twins were now making farting noises.
"Were the Romans Christians?" I asked him, remembering my curiosity at the Roman farm.
"Not always," Raven said. "They had their own gods once, but they gave them up to become Christians. And after that, they knew nothing but defeat." "Where are our men?"
"Still in the marsh," I said. Ubba had hoped to stay in the camp and so force Edmund's army to attack along the narrow neck of land and die on our short earthen wall. But instead, the English had remained south of the treacherous lowland and were inviting us to attack them. Ubba was tempted. He had made Storri cast the runestics, and rumour said that the result was uncertain, and that fed Ubba's caution. He was a fearsome fighter, but always wary when it came to picking a fight. But the runesticks had not predicted disaster, and so he had taken the army out into the marsh, where it now stood on whatever patches of drier land it could find, and from where two tracks led up to the lower ridge.
End of Disc 4.